it's time for Native Sun, a program bringing you indigenous news stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. We are reading stories from the Circle and Audubon Society. The first story comes from The Circle, Beyond the Algorithm, How AI Can Support Native Communities by Orion Williams. Artificial intelligence is changing everything from how we communicate and learn to how we shop, work, and heal. For Native communities, the rise of AI brings both caution and possibility. If approached with care, intention, and Indigenous leadership, AI could help preserve culture, improve access to services, and support sovereignty in powerful ways. Language revitalization. One of the most exciting opportunities lies in language preservation. Across Indian country, tribes are racing against time to keep Native languages alive. Elders who are fluent in Ojibwe, Dakota, Lakota, and other Indigenous languages are passing on, and younger generations often lack fluent speakers to learn from. AI tools such as voice recognition, natural language processing, and translation models could become vital allies in this effort. Imagine an app that hears you speak and offers genetic corrections in Ojibwe, or a voice assistant that helps kids learn new Dakota words while they play. AI, when trained carefully and with community input, can help turn endangered languages into everyday tools again. Projects like Google's Woolaroo, an open-source platform for Indigenous language translation, and local initiatives using ChatGPT-style models for tribal dialects are just the beginning. The Cherokee Nation has launched an ambitious language project to digitize and preserve the Cherokee language using AI-assisted tools. Similarly, the Blackfeet Community College in Montana is experimenting with AI to create digital language learning companions. The most important element is tribal control. Who trains the AI, who owns the data, and who gets to access it. Cultural preservation. From oral histories to regalia patterns, Native culture is often held in stories, images, and practices passed down through generations. AI can help digitize and organize this knowledge, making it accessible to future generations without stripping it of its sacredness. For example, a tribal archive powered by AI might catalog audio interviews with elders, identify beadwork styles across decades, or help map ancestral territories using satellite imagery and oral maps combined. These systems must be designed with cultural protocols in mind. Some stories are not meant for public access. Some songs are not meant to be recorded. AI must learn to respect boundaries, and that requires Indigenous oversight at every level. In Canada, the First Nations Information Governance Center, FNIGC, is working on frameworks for AI and data systems that honor cultural sensitivity. Meanwhile, the Shoal Lake 40 First Nation is collaborating with universities to map sacred sites using AI-powered geospatial tools that integrate oral history with environmental data. Native technologists are also developing models that filter sensitive cultural data through permission-based systems. This ensures that what's shared remains within the community, protected, honored, and never exploited. AI-powered education platforms can help close the gap between rural schools and resources. Personalized learning systems can be trained to include Indigenous perspectives, land-based knowledge, and tribal history, making lessons more engaging and relevant. Imagine an AI tutor that teaches math using examples from fishing or wild rice harvesting, or a history assistant that highlights Native resistance movements alongside state history. AI can help decolonize education if Indigenous educators and creators are the ones guiding its design. The Alaskan Native Tribal Health Consortium and tribal colleges in North Dakota have piloted AI systems for culturally responsive STEM learning. Teachers can customize lessons using Indigenous stories and localized examples, ensuring students stay connected to identity and land. AI can personalize learning experiences, tailoring content to individual student learning styles and cultural backgrounds, making STEM subjects more relatable. And the AI platforms can adapt lesson plans based on student performance, ensuring minority students receive targeted support. Storytelling is another space where AI can shine. Tools like Suno or Adobe's Firefly allow native artists to create immersive digital stories using traditional songs, visuals, and modern techniques. With the right creative spark, AI becomes a tool to share stories across generations, not erase them. Access to quality healthcare is a challenge for many Native communities, especially those in rural or underserved areas. AI can assist with telemedicine, diagnostics, and mental health support, as long as it's done ethically. For instance, AI chatbots can provide mental health check-ins or crisis support during times when a human counselor isn't available. Predictive tools can monitor chronic illnesses or flag potential health risks based on patterns. AI can also help bridge gaps between patients and providers by offering translation or cultural context. In Montana, the Blackfeet Nation has partnered with the Indian Health Service and university researchers to explore AI tools that help identify early warning signs of diabetes-related complications. By analyzing data from wearable devices and health records, always under strict tribal data governance, the project aims to improve preventable care while honoring community values. It's a small but significant step toward culturally informed, tech-supported healthcare in Indian country. These tools must be used to support human healthcare, not replace it. Indigenous input is critical to ensure that health data isn't misused and that solutions are culturally competent. Economic opportunities. AI isn't just something that happens to Native communities. It's something that Native communities can help shape. Tech-savvy youth, artists, business owners, and storytellers are already finding ways to use AI for economic empowerment. Creators are using AI tools to design art prints, write books, and build online shops. Small businesses are using AI-powered scheduling, inventory, and marketing tools to compete with larger brands. And young people are learning how to prompt, code, and build, turning their skills into digital careers. In New Mexico, the Native Women Lead Network has partnered with local AI labs to offer training workshops for Indigenous women entrepreneurs. The Indian Country Today newsroom has also started using AI tools to summarize tribal council minutes and assist in reporting, freeing up time for deeper journalism. This approach aligns with a broader trend in journalism where AI is being leveraged to enhance efficiency and coverage. What's needed now is infrastructure and investment, tribal internet access, training programs, ethical AI education, and support for Indigenous-led startups in tech. The challenge of data sovereignty. With great power comes great data. Every time you use an AI tool, it learns something about your voice, your language, your choices. For Native nations, protecting that data is paramount. Data sovereignty means that tribes have the right to control their own digital information. Just like physical land, digital land must be protected. That includes tribal enrollment records, cultural documents, health data, and more. Some tribes are now writing their own AI policies, working with legal experts and technologists to ensure that their data is not taken or misused. Others are exploring open source AI models that they can host on their own servers, keeping full control. The goal isn't to reject AI, but to embrace it in ways that are safe, sovereign, and community-centered. What comes next? AI isn't going away, but how it grows and who it serves is still up for grabs. For Native communities, this is a chance to lead, to innovate, and to reclaim the future on Indigenous terms. Whether it's a grandmother recording songs for an AI language tool, a teen building a Native meme generator, or a tribal college launching an AI coding bootcamp, the path forward is already being walked. The invitation is open, not to fear the machine, but to shape it. Next is Safeguarding the Sacred by Rachel Neuer from Audubon Magazine. On a brisk December night, three men gathered in Cyril, a speck of a town in southwest Oklahoma. They had come for a special purpose, one that connected them to their Comanche ancestors and channeled powers beyond the physical realm. Tonight, they would be roadmen, the spiritual leaders of peyote meetings. This ceremonial practice involves all-night sessions of prayer and song, at which attendees may consume the psychoactive cactus peyote. Many Indigenous Americans, especially those who are members of the Native American Church, consider it to be integral to their culture. "It's who we are," says Charles Taha, one of the Comanche roadmen present at the demonstration that evening. Kneeling in a small room painted a bright marigold yellow, Taha and his spiritual brothers, Travis Codina and Randall Foy, lowered their heads, closed their eyes, and began to sing. They were sharing just a few of the countless journey songs that would be sung at an actual peyote meeting. Chanting in Comanche, their voices rose and fell to a rapid beat they kept with a gourd rattle and water drum. Even non-speakers could pick out one distinctive word in their several songs: golden eagle. That species' special energy was also present in fans the men held, each made from a full set of tail feathers. The fans are crucial for peyote meetings. Ceremonial prayers cannot reach the heavens without them. To anyone else, they're just feathers. But to us, they're something special and powerful, Taha says. They're wind made flesh. Virtually all Native American tribes assign special importance to feathers and other parts from a wide array of birds. Feathers are believed to encapsulate the animal's energy, and they serve different ceremonial purposes depending on the culture. For Comanches, golden eagles are the most cherished. Historically, the belief of our people is that only the golden eagle can fly high enough and far enough to see the face of God, says Waha Thuwika, co-director of SIA, the Comanche Nation Ethno-Orthological Initiative. SIA, which means feather, has captive bred and released hundreds of golden eagle and bald eagles, helping to rebuild wild populations. The organization is also one of the few places Native Americans can legally obtain feathers for cultural and spiritual purposes, and it runs the only repository of feathers from both eagle and non-eagle species. The feathers in the fans of Taha, Foy, and Codina used that December were molted by golden eagles that live at SIA, and the group supplies members about 150 tribes per year with feathers from a wide range of revered birds. SIA makes a unique contribution to the ornithological world, says Patrick Redig, co-founder and director emeritus of the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota. It's fundamentally blending the cultural history and the importance of the eagle to the Comanche and other Native American tribes, but with an eye to addressing the conservation of the eagle in modern times, he says. Such an operation just doesn't exist elsewhere, and it's really important to eagles because they need it. They need advocates. Eagles face a multitude of threats, including collisions with wind turbines and power lines, lead poisoning, and habitat loss. Now the growing popularity of peyote meetings within and beyond Native communities, as well as an increasing demand for regalia for powwows, is feeding a black market for eagle feathers. Waha Thuwika and Troy, SIA's other co-director, he doesn't use a surname, have watched as the sale and use of illicit feathers has exploded, Troy says, especially in the past couple of years. Deeply concerned about the impact of this escalating illegal trade, they are fighting to save eagles while maintaining their culture. "We live in a time when an eagle can no longer forfeit her life to satisfy culture, not any culture," Waha Thuwika says. Golden eagles have always been part of Waha Thuwika's life. He can trace his family back through seven generations of Numununu, as Comanches call themselves, on his mother's side. His family's historical responsibility was to maintain the birdways, he says. His German-Irish father had his own obsession with birds and could identify a feather blindfolded just by its texture. "That's how I first got to know the birds, through the plumage," says Waha Thuwika, whose Anglo name is William Volker. His father amassed a collection of raptor feathers, including some 2,200 golden eagle tail sets and numerous carcasses, many sent from ranchers when eagle persecution was commonplace, before the government strengthened protections. Eagles were first federally protected under the 1900 Lacey Act, which bans the trade and transportation of bird parts across state lines or international borders. Then in 1918, Migratory Bird Treaty Act made it illegal to harm, kill, or keep any native migratory bird or part without a permit. But by the 1930s, it was clear that stricter regulations were needed to stem the decline of eagles from rampant shooting and habitat loss. In 1940, the government passed the Bald Eagle Protection Act, adding heftier penalties for harming the birds or possessing or selling their feathers or other parts. For the Golden Eagle Amendment to that act, passed in 1962, Wahathuika's father worked with federal authorities to create language and protocols that supported Native cultural interests, ensuring Native Americans and others could legally keep feathers and parts already in their possession. In 1972, George Sutton, an acquaintance and leading ornithologist, arranged for Wahathuika to take graduate-level courses at Cornell University. There he shared quarters with Pride, a beloved golden eagle he brought with him, and studied ornithology, avian physiology, and genetics. He also established connections with prominent raptor experts, including Tom Cade, who founded the Peregrine Fund, a raptor conservation nonprofit. When he returned home, Wahathuika continued working with birds, including through a captive breeding program and avian surveys. One day in 1979, he broke a personal rule and picked up a hitchhiker. The young white man was Troy. "There was a baby eagle sitting on the back seat," Troy recalls. "I'm like, what the heck is going on here?" Wahathuika explained that he was releasing the captive bred chick into the care of wild foster parents. Troy, who had recently left the army after being injured in a helicopter crash, was fascinated. That summer, he joined Wahathuika on an annual eagle banding survey on the historic lands. On their final day, tragedy nearly struck when two eaglets jumped from their nest and landed in the North Laramie River. Troy immediately leapt into the fast-flowing water and saved them. You're listening to Native Son on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Back at Wahathuika's parents' house, his grandmother summoned Troy to a fire in the backyard and began a ceremony to take him captive. Only Comanches born prior to the tribe's final surrender to the U.S. troops in the late 1800s were permitted to take these captives, a practice historically reserved for young people whose families Comanches had killed. His grandmother was the last Comanche known to invoke this privilege, which made Troy a member of the family and tribe. Though neither man had told her about Troy's heroism, she named him "He Who Saves the Eagle from the Water." In addition to monitoring wild eagles, the duo began working to rebuild the raptors' populations. Employing an artificial insemination technique that Wahathuika had pioneered, they produced and released more than 400 golden and bald eagles into the wild from the 1970s through the early 1990s. Wahathuika and Troy formalized their efforts in 1999 with the creation of SIA. The center, funded primarily by donations, combines elements of a museum, an archive, shrine, botanical garden, and raptor sanctuary. One room is dedicated research space, packed floor to ceiling with books, historical documents, and photographs related to both eagle and Comanches. Another is a state-of-the-art archival storage facility. Eagles are at the center of SIA's operations. Many of more than 100 resident raptors are captive-bred eagles, some of them descendants of several generations of Comanche birds. SIA also provides a home for some formerly wild birds that cannot be released, especially species significant to Comanches. That includes two wing-injured Harlan hawks, a crested caracara born with a feather deformity, and a zone-tailed hawk that was hit by a car. Wahathuika and Troy, who don't give themselves salaries, live on the property. "This is not a job," Wahathuika explains. "This is a hereditary life calling." SIA's influence extends far beyond Oklahoma. In 2012, SIA signed an agreement with the Spanish government to establish a joint raptor conservation center in Spain, where they produced Maria, the first captive-bred Spanish imperial eagle. That partnership also provides symbolic restitution for the horses and metal that Comanche raiders took from the Spanish settlers on the southern plains 3 centuries ago. Wahothuwika explains after several major zoos had failed in an attempt, Sia succeeded in hatching the first captive-bred Hawaiian hawk in 2016. The center is also the only place in the Western Hemisphere to propagate non-native species, such as steppe eagles, which it provides to dozens of zoological partners. Sia does things in this world that nobody else does with raptors, says Benjamin Tuggle, former Southwest Regional Director for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, FWS. Wahothuwika attributes their success to listening to the birds, looking to them for cues that identify their needs in terms of food and habitat. Even as Sia helped bolster wild eagle populations and build expertise important to raptor conservation, Wahothuwika and Troy had a larger, tougher goal, one that married their devotion to eagles with their fervent support of traditional native practices. For decades, tribes had lacked a way to legally obtain culturally important feathers. Sia wanted to provide a solution to that problem. Under the 1962 Golden Eagle Amendment, the Department of the Interior was required to provide tribal members some means for accessing bald and golden eagle feathers and carcasses. Years passed, however, the department struggled to fulfill the obligation. So around the time Wahothuwika went to Cornell University, he sent a proposal to the FWS to create an indigenous-run feather repository that would build on his father's substantial collection and help meet the needs of tribes. Indigenous traditional practitioners have the experience and understand the nuance of meeting the needs of other traditional practitioners, Wahothuwika explains. The feds weren't interested, he says. We heard things like, this is like putting the fox in charge of the henhouse. In 2010, thanks to his efforts, the FWS granted Sia a special permit to distribute non-eagle feathers under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. With its 2 separate permits, today Sia is the only repository for all types of feathers. Sia stores hundreds of thousands of feathers for more than 200 species in a warehouse off-site. Rehab groups, zoos, and falconers help maintain the supply. Sia fulfills requests from around 150 tribes per year, mainly for raptors, but also for songbirds, as well as those long-sought condor and crane feathers. Sia provides all feathers for free and covers shipping costs out of an abundance of caution for the law. They only supply for bona fide cultural purposes. If there's any doubt as to how the feathers will be used, they rely on a verification process using connections within the tribal world. Even so, demand outstrips supply. This is especially true for eagles. Sia can send out feathers only from the 8 bald eagles and 20 golden eagles currently in its care, or from those in its collection that predate the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. Sia is also working to obtain the authority to distribute eagle feathers from other sources, just as the government does through the National Repository. Wahothuwika estimates they have a backlog of around 80 eagle applications, which will take a few years to work through. Those outstanding requests are for specially prized juvenile golden eagle tail feathers, which are the most whitish with black tips, unlike the all-dark feathers of adults. Lethal means for procuring feathers are still practiced today with very different methods. Illegal shooting is a leading cause of death for eagles in the western United States, according to a 2023 study. It's also grown more brazen. Last October, for instance, a U.S. district judge in Montana sentenced a man to nearly 4 years in prison and ordered him to pay more than $775,000 in restitution for killing more than 3,600 birds, including 118 eagles, on the Flathead Indian Reservation. Officers estimated the poacher earned up to $360,000 by selling eagle feathers and parts online. We're going to feel the impact of the Flathead Reservation raptor loss for years to come, said Mike Dolson, chairman of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai Tribes, in a statement. When it comes to federal law enforcement cracking down on illicit online sales, Laurie Marshall, now former Assistant Chief of Public Affairs for the FWS, said in an email that the agency conducts many investigations into the purchases of eagle feathers and parts. Violators usually receive verbal warnings or tickets. She added, however, that the FWS does not have the personnel to undertake time-consuming investigations of the eagle feather trade on social media. The FWS did not respond to follow-up questions. Wahothuwika and Troy have started pursuing their own solutions. They now implant all of the feathers and feather-containing items they send out with microchips linked to a registry that confirms their legal provenance. The chips could make it easier for FWS agents to identify legally acquired feathers if and when they began cracking down on the illegal trade. Wahathuika says FWS law enforcement staff came to SIA for a demonstration in 2010, but the agency didn't respond to a request for comment about the technology. SIA also engages in outreach and educational programs with tribal, national, and international groups, and these efforts seem to be making some difference. The Pueblos are starting to think about getting feathers and other things from places like SIA rather than going out to poach, says Mary Mota Wiaki, a retired archaeologist and member of the Comanche Nation and the Santa Clara Pueblo. Another solution SIA has long advocated is creating a network of regional feather repositories for both eagle and non-eagle species. SIA would provide training and advice if desired. Tribes would obtain feathers from the same places SIA currently does, rehabbers, falconers, zoos, and more, but would work with partners in their area. Not only would this help meet demand, it would also empower tribes to take control of the sourcing of their sacred items. In addition, it could give value to the countless carcasses and feathers from birds other than golden and bald eagles that are currently thrown out or incinerated around the country. Imagine if every tribe did this with their own feathers, Troy says. It would be regenerative. No bird would have to be killed. Making this vision a reality would require people who are as committed as Wahathuika and Troy. While Western society tends to see Native American culture as something from the past, a growing number of younger Native people like Taha, Foy, and Kodina are devoted to revitalizing an older, more culturally authentic way of doing things. They give us some hope of these ways continuing, Wahathuika says. Another hopeful portent came in April of 2025. The FWS granted SIA authority to release unlimited numbers of captive-produced bald and golden eagles on historic lands in 6 states, from Texas to Montana, for 30 years. The permit signals a return to indigenous people engaging in the truest form of conservation of species for which we depend culturally and spiritually, Wahathuika says. It is also a victory for the sanctity of eagle life. As long as eagles soar and Comanches call on their energy, at SIA, the birdways, too, will still be fiercely alive. You've been listening to Native Sun, a show for Indigenous issues on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Your reader is Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is Landback by Hallucination.